Well, we're up to Psalm 7 here in the series, and I'm not committing to do all 150 psalms, but so far there has been some good, interesting and applicable stuff in each new psalm that I've seen, so I'm going to keep going here as long as that continues. Psalm 7 is, most of your translations say it's a Shigeon of David. Shigeon is just a transliteration of the Hebrew word, Shigeon, which is found nowhere else in the Bible. So nobody really knows, is quite sure what this means. The two-thirds of this word, Shug, is the same as the word for meditate, which we see in Psalm 1 and 2. So the New King James has translated it a meditation, but the Jewish commentators and word scholars I've read say they think it actually comes from a different root, meaning shagah, to err or go astray. It's interesting. I thought that Franz Delitzsch, who's a classic commentator on the Old Testament, had the best idea to call it a reel. It kind of catches that idea of going astray, or a dithyrambic poem with a rapid change of strong emotions. Whatever it was something that David sang to the Lord. Have you ever had conflicting emotions and sang to the Lord in order to process it? This is what David did. When our heads and emotions are spinning over something we don't understand, or over a threat that frightens us, let the music of psalms and hymns and spiritual songs flow through your mind and restore your perspective. This particular psalm has been traditionally used at the Feast of Purim. That's where the Jews remember God turning the tables on Haman's slander against Mordecai, and God turning the tables on Mordecai's plans to exterminate the Jewish race that was in the Babylonian Empire. The Feast of Purim remembers how God rescued the Jews and raised Mordecai up from being slandered and on death row, as it were, to actually becoming second in command of the king and a very trusted man. I'm sure all of us have had experiences where we have been falsely accused and threatened. And this psalm addresses what to do when we are panicking over someone's accusations against us and the kind of fallout that we're afraid might happen if everybody else were to believe what they said is true. In David's case, it was someone named Cush ben Yamini. If you translate those Hebrew words into English word for word, it would be a black son of my right hand. Martin Luther, as he tried to figure out who this was, figured it was that Cush was a figurative term for someone with a black heart. And that he must have been a courtier who was someone at David's right hand, but who was treacherous. The name Cush, as it is spelled here in Hebrew, doesn't show up anywhere else in the Bible except to describe Noah's grandson, who was the progenitor of the Ethiopian nation, and so Ethiopia is called Cush throughout the Old Testament. This particular spelling of the word for Benjamite has a hyphen between Ben and Yemeni. That exact spelling doesn't show up anywhere else in the Bible. So that doesn't really help us, although there is a somewhat similar spelling of the word where the hyphen is missing, and instead there's a space and an additional Hebrew letter H. Three times that spell, that slightly different spelling, shows up in the Bible describing Shimei, who was from the tribe of Benjamin. So some Bible scholars say that this Cush Benyamini is Shimei, a man from Benjamin who cursed David. Remember, when David was fleeing from Absalom, who was trying to take over the kingdom, he's running away, and Shimei is running alongside the ridge above him, throwing rocks at him and cursing David. Some people think that the words of that man as he's run along the ridge throwing rocks down at David and his soldiers as they're fleeing from Absalom, these are the words that disturbed David and brought forth this psalm. I actually don't think that's who it is, although it's a fair conjecture. A number of ancient scholars have said this refers actually to Cushi, another Cushi, who lived at the same time and was actually named Cush. There was one who was David's counselor, and he sabotaged Absalom's coup. And there's another one who announced that after the war between David's men and Absalom's men, there was a Cushite who ran to David and announced, "Your son Absalom is dead, and may the Lord do so to all your enemies." James Montgomery Boyce, in his commentary on this psalm, said that it points out a truth, that many people from the tribe of Benjamin were not real happy about David becoming king. David was a Judean, so he was from a different tribe than Saul was. Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin, so people from Benjamin kind of naturally got perks because the king was from their tribe. And so when a man from another tribe becomes king instead of Saul, then they were disaffected. The Benjamites felt somewhat disaffected, and we do that. The Sheba, who led the rebellion against David, he was from Benjamin. And of course, Shimei was also from the tribe of Benjamin. So this may have just been another guy from that same tribe that isn't described anywhere else, but said something particularly hurtful to David. My opinion, however, is that this name Cush is referring elliptically to King Saul himself. He's the son of Cush or Kish, same basic word, and Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. And the closest Hebrew spelling to the word Benjamite here in the Bible is where Saul says, "I'm from the tribe of Benjamin. I'm a Benyamini." All the letters are the same. That just doesn't have a hyphen. And when we consider the rest of this psalm, I think it fits very well with the situation where David was, before David became king, that the time period, several years, where Saul, as king, was feeling threatened by David, and David had to escape from his position in the palace to live in the wilderness, and Saul kept trying to kill David and kept sending troops out to chase David around through the Judean wilderness and try to kill him. I think that fits very well with the first verse, "Save me from those who are pursuing me. Deliver me." Saul and his men were chasing David around the desert, trying to hunt him down and kill him. David had a real fear of being killed. It was a real possibility. The accusations were flying against David. He's living out there in the wilderness, he's got this, hundreds of men that are trained warriors around him, and Saul is scared. And there has been word that a prophet has said David's going to be the next king instead of the king's son Jonathan, Saul is constantly worried about an insurrection coming from David. And these rumors keep flying. David is not submitting to your authority. David is starting a group of rebels down in the south. David's going to try to take over your kingdom, Saul. We see guys like Doeg, who was at the temple, and he saw David eating at the temple. And Doeg goes back to Saul and he says, "I saw David eating in the temple. He must be starting an insurrection against you." And so Saul sends a whole army to the town of Nob to kill all the priests in the temple. He's so afraid of David trying to overthrow him. David is rightly worried about being killed, or at least it's a legitimate concern. There is this one interesting comment in verse 4, the end of verse 4. Some English translations, not all, I don't know if it's in yours, but some of them will, the King James translates this, "delivered my adversary." There were two times when David had it in his power to kill Saul. Saul was out with an army trying to kill David, and David was able to get close enough to touch Saul while Saul was sleeping in his army camp. Two different occasions, David could have killed Saul. Saul was out there trying to kill him, so it could have been justified as fair. But David didn't. He delivered his enemy twice. Both times Saul acted embarrassed that he had falsely accused David of insurrection. But then Saul changed his mind and go about and try to kill David again. So David prays. He would step into the psalm here after kind of looking at the context a little bit, or at least what I think the context is. In verse 1, "Yahweh my God, in you I have taken refuge." This is what David is praying as he is dealing with the false accusations that he's an insurrectionist and fleeing for his life, hiding out in the desert while Saul is trying to chase him down, kill him. "In you, my God, I've taken refuge. Cause to save me from all my pursuers and cause to deliver me." This word for trust or take refuge is the same one that's in Psalm 2. "Blessed are all who take refuge in him." Same as Psalm 5:11, "Let all who take refuge in you be glad." And in verse 2, he says, "Otherwise, he," and I think that's speaking of Saul, "will tear my soul apart like a lion rips, and there'll be no deliverer." Tearing, rending, ripping, or dragging, if you NAS, present a gruesome image of a cat and mouse game. If you've ever seen your house cat slowly kill some small animal and just slowly maiming little part by part of that poor little animal, and every time the animal tries to jump up and run away, the cat maims it a little bit more, grabs it. David's afraid that Saul's going to do this to him or some other ruthless man like Doeg or Ahithophel. We have a real concern. We have a spiritual enemy that is also about doing the same kind of thing to us. Satan, as described in the book of Job, chapter 16, in the same way as a lion that is out to progressively maim him. In Hosea 5, however, we see that God himself can be that lion who strategically tears his people in discipline and then heals the tears that he makes. That's a fascinating picture that I wish I could go into further. But we do have an enemy. None of us, unless some of our soldiers go out in the battlefield, you may have somebody that wants to physically maim you. All of us have a spiritual enemy, Satan, who wants to maim us spiritually through bringing us into temptation and to sin. God himself, though, some of the wounds we receive actually come from the hand of God in order to change us and bring healing to us. I want to consider for a moment the messianic implications of this psalm. Augustine, is typical of the early church father, spends a lot of time looking at this psalm from the perspective of Jesus, and I think that's appropriate to, as part of the study of any psalm, try plugging Jesus in as the main character, as the archetype of the psalmist himself. Early on in his ministry, Jesus was tempted by the devil, right? The devil who is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, as Peter tells us. Can you see how Jesus, when he was tempted for 40 days in the wilderness, could have prayed this same prayer? God, deliver me from the tempter, or else there will be no deliverer. You know, God, I'm the deliverer of mankind. I can't fall into sin, or there will be no deliverer, God. Deliver me. Jesus endured much slander against himself from the Pharisees. And they did, of course, set traps for him and eventually caught him through the betrayal of his close friend Jesus. But Jesus had done no wrong. There was no wrong on his hands, no evil on his hands. He didn't deserve to die. And even as he was headed to the cross, he said, look, I could have called a legion of angels to come and rescue me from the cross rescue me from the injustice of being crucified. But he didn't. Why didn't Jesus call forth justice for himself? It was because, as we see in verse 10, my shield is upon God. He's hung his shield or hung his hat on God's plan of salvation and is going to comply with what God wants to do in salvation. He prioritized God saving a holy people. So Jesus died on the cross to pay for the sins of those people and save us believers from getting torn up by the devil, from being condemned by the God of justice, who would otherwise find us all guilty of eternal death. As Jesus was on the cross, the nations surrounded him, mocking him, and yet he returned on high, right? When he ascended to heaven and stood at the right hand of God. And in heaven, Jesus intercedes for us. He says, judge, O Lord, according to my righteousness, not according to their sin. I've already paid the price of their sin by my death and given them my perfect righteousness. So judge them by that righteousness, my righteousness, not theirs. And of course, we know Jesus will come again to judge all the nations, at which time he will try the heart and mind of every individual person, and he'll put a final end to all evil, and he will secure a final salvation at the same time for all those whom he loves. So can you see how Jesus himself can be seen as a fulfillment? This is not the only fulfillment of this psalm, but he is he is pictured by this psalm, the position that he is in as the Savior. Coming back to verse 3, the psalmist prays, Yahweh, my God, if I did this, if there is iniquity or wrong or injustice or unrighteousness or guilt, depending on which translation you're looking at, if this unfairness is being kept in the hollow of my hand, then this evil is defined in the law as prejudice or unfairness when it comes to judgment that's done by a leader. In Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice, that's the word in the psalm here, You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. So this unfairness or iniquity or injustice in my hand could refer to David as a leader being accused of doing something unjust, partiality in judgment. Or it could be, it's in other places in the law, this same word is used to speak of cheating in business deals on measurements of weight or value. Something that any person involved in business might do, a sin that we might commit. Deuteronomy 25 speaks of having a heavier stone and a lighter stone in your bag, so that when you're selling your product to the customer, and you tell them, well, it's a dollar a pound, you pull out your, you know, you put your pound of product there on one side of the scale, and you pull out your heavy rock and put it down there. Well, no, so you pull out your light rock, right? Pull out the light rock, and so you say, well, this is a pound of product, when it's really a little less than a pound because you pulled out your light rock for that. And then when they say, okay, that'll be a pound in silver, pay me for that product, you pull out your heavy stone and put it down on the one side of the scales, and they have to put more than a pound of silver in order to match that stone. So that was a way that they cheated in those days. David says, if I'm in the middle of bilking somebody like that, then hold me accountable. How many of us could say that with a clean conscience? How many of us have never been unfair with anybody under our authority? Or have never made more than we should have in all of our business deals. Our reputation is something to consider there, and which reflects God's character as we're called by His name. In David's case, however, he's been unfairly accused. Rumors are circulating that he's mobilizing an army to overthrow King Saul, although it was never David's intention. But a rumor like that's no small matter. It could get David killed. It could start a civil war. It was very serious. Synonymous words, David asks this very question of Saul in 1 Samuel 26. When Saul comes out, David sees him, and David says, "Why then is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What evil is in my hand? I haven't done anything against you, Saul." Verse 4, if I have rewarded or repaid or retaliated against him who is at peace with me, or he's who's my friend, if you're looking at the NAS, the word is shalom there, peace. Saul himself confessed that this was not true of David, using this very word. 1 Samuel 24, he says to David, "You are more righteous than I am, for you have repaid me with good, while I repaid evil to you. The Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me." I mentioned a little earlier that the end of verse 4 has two different translations, and I'll get into that now. The verb is based on halatz, to escape, or literally to remove, or be removed. And so this removal could be looked at negatively in terms of, if I have removed value from him, I plundered or robbed him or spoiled his goods, if I did it for an empty reason, for no good reason, without cause. If I tried to steal the kingdom away from you, Saul, then I did wrong and I deserve to be punished. And I think, you know, that's one way that this is interpreted. Another way this is interpreted is as a positive removal and a deliverance. And that's the way the King James and traditional Jewish scholars have interpreted it. He had no cause to be my enemy, and so justice required me to deliver him, which is what David did with Saul when Saul was hunting him in the desert. And David's saying, look, I let Saul get away scot-free twice, and what good did it do me? is all for nothing. I think actually the negative removal makes more sense. If I've done all these bad things, then let an enemy pursue and overtake my soul and stamp out my life into the ground, lay my glory in the dirt. There's a progression there, you know, chasing him down, catching up with him, trampling him down, treading him down, and then burying him in the dirt. Now, according to God's laws of justice, that would be fair, because the wages of sin is death. David admits that if the charge is true, then capital punishment would be fair. If I've been unjust in my treatment of this guy, then I wouldn't be presenting my case before you, Lord, for justice. I'd say he was right to keep on pursuing and persecuting me. Now, I think it's important to note, I don't think David is saying he'd never, ever done anything wrong, but that in the case of this particular accusation, he's innocent. He's not tried to overthrow King Saul. Many of us have encountered false accusations. As I thought through this, I've thought of quite a few stories, and I don't know how appropriate it would be for me to share them. So I probably it's a common enough experience that you can think of a time when somebody accused you of wrongdoing when you hadn't actually done that thing wrong. How do you deal with that? That's really hard for me to deal with, especially when other people start thinking that I'm doing something wrong and I didn't do it. How should we respond when people falsely accuse us? Should we respond in kind, start accusing back? No, that brings us down to our accuser's level. But often if we start protesting, then people start saying, you know, methinks he doth protest too much. And so, you know, when you try to clear your own name, then people start getting suspicious of you and think maybe you did it after all. But if you're innocent, you can't even confess that you did anything. You can't clear it. You can't confess it and repent. Can't make restoration because you didn't do it. What can you do? Especially if you don't have the power to set it straight. You know, it's those times when you don't really have the power to set the record straight, right? That's when it's upsetting. That's when it tears you up. Is when you don't have a way to tell everybody, no, I didn't do it. There's only one thing you can do, and that's take your problem to God, which is what David models here. We can appeal to God for justice, whereas a false accusation may deceive and convince our fellow human beings, it cannot deceive God. And God knows the truth. He'll set it straight in his record, even if other people get it wrong. So that's why David appeals to God. Arise, Yahweh, in your anger. Verse 6. Be lifted up by the excesses of my adversaries and stir up for me the judgment you decreed. I think the word arise here is in keeping with the Hebrew use of the word arise for what a prosecutor did in the courtroom. Of course, it wasn't in a room, it was in a gate courtyard. But when the prosecutor accused the accused person, the prosecutor would stand to level the accusations before the judges who were seated. Judges are seated at the gate. Prosecutors arises and prosecutes. And I think that's what David is asking God to do. Prosecute these people, God, because of or against the rage and fury of my foes. Literally, their passings over, the word avar, pass over, or excesses, is the Hebrew word there, of my adversaries. In other words, my enemies have gone too far in their anger against me. They flipped out over a false rumor, and they have done me wrong in the process. Now I need you, God, to intervene and restore justice. I appeal this case to you. So wake up, arouse your justice, or you know, call a court into session so that things can be made right. There is some dispute here in verse 6 over how to translate the Hebrew word Eli. The Masoretic vowel points that were added around 900 AD clearly indicate the preposition for and the object me. But if you don't include the vowels, it could be read my God, and that's what the Septuagint interpreted it 1,000 years before the Masoretic vowel pointings. And if you're reading in NIV, it sides with the way the Septuagint interpreted this. Awake, my God. Either interpretation works with the rest of the Bible. But in my opinion, since the next two words in Hebrew are the noun for judgment and then the verb commanded, it appears to be the object of what is to be stirred up and awakened rather than a separate parallel sentence. So, awaken judgment, you decreed it. The word for commanded or appointed or decreed is not spelled like the other Hebrew imperatives in this verse. There are imperatives. Rise up, be lifted up, awaken. But this one, you commanded, is a plain old perfect tense verb. I think it's speaking of the character of God. You've commanded justice. This is what you have done throughout history. You've given a law. You've revealed law to us. You've shown us what is just, what is unjust. And consistently throughout history, you have cast judgments upon the wicked and blessed your people. This is what you do. You command justice. This is your character, God. So now let your character motivate you as you see their sin and become angry about your sin. Let that motivate you to enter into the justice that you promised you would instigate against them. And then verse 7 describes the courtroom scene. The assembly of peoples will mill about you, and so return over it to the height. The congregation, they can be God's people, like the assembly of the righteous in Psalm 1:5. Or it can be a band of bad guys, like the assembly of evildoers in Psalm 22:16 that surrounded the psalmist like dogs. Note that this assembly has multiple peoples in it. So it's not just Jews. It's Jews and Gentiles surrounding or milling around the judge or the accuser, perhaps, the prosecuting attorney. I see this particular assembly as being witnesses to the court trial. These are the nations, either witnesses or in the galley, observing. I'm reminded of the scene in the old movie To Kill a Mockingbird, where a white woman falsely accused a black man of taking advantage of her, and so she takes him to court. And everybody in town shows up in the courtroom to see whether justice is going to be done. Everybody kind of knows that the black man didn't, everybody that knows the black man knows he didn't do wrong. Everybody that really knows the white woman knew that she didn't have a great reputation. And so all the black folks in town are sitting up in the balcony, just leaning forward, listening. What is the court going to decide? Is it going to decide to give a just sentence? If it doesn't give a just sentence, what are they going to? Will they ever trust the justice system again? No, they're not going to. They're not going to trust the justice of God. The nations are not going to trust the justice of God if they watch a just man get condemned and not get the justice righteousness he deserves. David's particular case is going to communicate to all the people in the world whether God is just or unjust. If God shows that he can deliver David and exercise justice, then others will want to take refuge in God's righteousness. Now, if David fails to appeal to God's justice, then there will be no theater for the nations to see whether God is just or not. I think that's something to consider. Like David, there is a place for us to set the stage by appropriately appealing for God's justice so that others will have an opportunity to see God at work bringing about justice. So he says, arise in your anger. Be lifted up by the excesses of my adversaries. Stir up for me the judgment you decreed. And this is going to give an opportunity for the nations all around to see that God is a just God. The first verb, I'm not gonna get into level of detail that minute. There is a question of whether the nations that are surrounding God here in this picture, whether they are those who are taking refuge in God, so they're gathering around Him, as some of the translations say, or whether they are the rioting, raging nations, raging against God and surrounding Him in an adversarial way. The wording in Hebrew doesn't tell us explicitly one way or the other. We know from the rest of the Psalms that both will be the case. There will be some from the nations who gather to the name of the Lord, and yet at the same time, there will be nations that seek to surround and pull God down. The conclusion of verse 7 is puzzling as well. If you read it, the Hebrew words, word for word, literally is over her, and her would refer to the assembly of the peoples, to the height you return. What does that mean? The King James renders this word over figuratively, meaning the psalmist wants God to return on high in order to offer some benefit to the peoples for their sakes. Figuratively, for their sakes, instead of literally in a position over. The other standard English translation seemed to imply that God in heaven returned to mankind, but still retain an exalted status as judge. As best I can figure, this on high doesn't mean in heaven in this case, but rather just means up on a high place. Marom is the Hebrew word. And I think that high place is the judge's seat. Again, just like it is in our courtrooms. You know, the judge sits up in the highest chair in the room. And so I think David is saying, you accuse the nations, and then go ascend into the judge's seat. You're not only the prosecuting attorney, you're also going to be the judge in this courtroom. That's what I think this means. Although many people see in this the triumphal ascension of Jesus after judging sin. Whatever is the case, we see in this picture, in this courtroom picture, both the transcendence and the immanence of God. He is transcendent, high, and over His people, and an authority judging them. But He's also immanent. He returns to dwell with His people, just like the cloud in the desert that followed the Israelites through the desert that returned and settled down among the people of Israel. And just like Jesus, as you see throughout the Bible, He's always the coming one, or the one who is to come. He's always the one that comes to be with us. We see that in the theophanies throughout the Old Testament, as well as the name that He gets, and you see it especially in the book of Revelation, the one who is to come. Yahweh will adjudicate peoples, verse 8, and judge me, Yahweh, according to my righteousness and according to my perfection over me. That's my translation of it, and I'll explain why I like that, according to my perfection over me. David asks God to judge him, and David expects to be vindicated in that judgment. the righteousness and integrity or perfection that he brings forth as a criterion for judgment are character traits of God, right? It's God who is righteous and perfect, not man. Yet David claims it as his own. How does that work? I think that the last two words of the sentence it provide the explanation, and it's literally the words "over me," or the word "over" is the same word translated "over" in verse 7, or "for their sakes" in the King James, "all." And then in verse 8, most English translations render this same word "all" with the English word "in." I think that's unfortunate. I think it's even more unfortunate that NIV rendered it "O Most High" instead of "over me." The same Hebrew word root is there, but I don't think that's an appropriate translation here. But as long as we recognize that this righteousness and integrity is not intrinsic to David, it comes from outside of him, from the Most High God. I think that's the point. The Lord is our righteousness, as Jeremiah 23:6 says. The Lord is our righteousness. His righteousness comes down upon us and into us. That is how there is righteousness in us, that we can ask God to judge on that basis, on the basis of the righteousness of Christ, which has come down over us and into us. On that basis, he says in Psalm 9, "Let the evil of the wicked men end, and you'll establish righteousness for yourself, and the God of righteousness will test mind and emotions." God will prove his righteousness by ending wickedness and establishing righteousness. God is also, or a righteous man, depending on how you want to interpret that. God is also testing the hearts and minds, literally the kidneys. But in Job and the Psalms and Jeremiah, the Kali vote is the innermost being or the emotions. God judges everything about us, all our thoughts, all our feelings, all our desires. God will judge all of that, and he understands all of that about us. And that's what gives him an advantage that no human judge has. When we go before human judges, they don't know what's going on inside your head. They can only judge based on evidence. But God knows exactly what everyone was thinking at every time. And so he can make perfect judgments. And that is going to be marvelous when we see that in action. I'm going to conclude with verse 10, where he says that "my shield is upon God, causing to save right-hearted ones." This is the same shield that we saw in Psalm 3, small enough to buckle onto your arm and use along with a sword. Here David says that he's thrown his shield upon God, literally upon. King James translates the shield as a defense. That's just a figurative way of doing that, which is fine. The second word in the Hebrew after "my shield" is the same preposition "all," translated "over" in verse 7, and "in" or "over me" at the end of verse 8. He's literally putting the shield upon God. The NIV extends that to mean "to the one who is high above." I think that's a bit of a stretch. The other English translations go with a different preposition, "of" or "with." I think the best translation of this is the word "upon." Even if we go with the preposition "in" or "with" instead of "over" or "upon," the meaning still comes through. My shield, my defense, rests upon God saving the righteous. That's the only way we're going to get through the judgment, is if God can save the righteous. As the old hymn goes, "My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness." It's Jesus' blood and righteousness that offer my hope in the judgment. I need no other argument. I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died and that he died for me, right? I rest my case on God saving me. And note that the word for upright is different from the word for righteous. The Hebrew word here, yashar, means straight. It's the same one as David prayed, make straight the way before me, in a couple psalms before. It means that their hearts are aligned with God, not that they're perfectly righteous, but they're aligned with God. They're straight, not crooked. They're level, not full of holes and deception. Notice here that God's judgment is the same time as our salvation. Judgment and salvation happen at the same time. His role of judge is related to his role as our Savior. It's only when Jesus has completed that final judgment that we see the fullness of our salvation and glory. I want to close with a quote from Gerald Wilson from his commentary on this psalm. He says, "The righteous character of Yahweh is the psalmist's basis for confidence." And so he invites us to understand divine righteousness as a source of confidence and comfort rather than of fear and dismay. So easy it is for us to say, God is so righteous and perfect, and I am so messed up that I don't dare come close to him. I don't want to look bad. I don't want to be shown up. In fact, I don't want to even go to church and be compared with all those other nice, righteous people, because I'm not as good as they are, and I don't want everybody to see that. I'm too messy. But what David says here is, no, that God's righteousness should not make us afraid of getting close to him. Instead, it should make us run to him so that we get his righteousness upon ourselves. That's what we want. We want to run to the Lord and take refuge in his righteousness.